From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Carl Castle, and here's your host at the Chase Bank Auditorium in downtown Chicago, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Carl. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, guys. Listen, today's show, you might notice, is a little different. It's a special look back at 2011. We're doing it with our friends at BBC America. The big change, well, our Not My Job guest is 100% more British than usual. It's author Neil Gaiman. He'll be with us later. But in addition, you will not be able to call in for this one. We're going to play with members of the audience here. And because it's a partially British show, whenever we say the word check, we'll be spelling it with a Q-U-E. All right, let's welcome our panel. First, say hello to a comedian and last comic standing champion, Alonzo Bowden.
Thank you, sir.
Next, a comedian and necktie model, Ms. Paula Poundstone. And joining us for the first time, the host of the quiz show Breakaway, seen next year on BBC, Mr. Nick Hancock. So welcome, everybody. We're going to start today with a game for the panel, a little something we're calling
Dear Friends and Family.
It's the season when folks send out holiday letters, and people in the news, well, they like to bore their families like everybody else does. Carl here is going to read excerpts for you from three of their letters. Panelists, your job is to tell us who sent them. Alonzo, this first one is for you. Carl, unseal that envelope.
Great news for the Berkowitz clan. Little Gary finally graduated from college and took a position on Wall Street. I guess he's working hard. He's even sleeping on Wall Street. I guess he doesn't like the food, though. He keeps complaining about the pepper spray.
So that letter is from the parents of a young man who, like many people, spent the fall doing what?
Occupying Wall Street.
Indeed, of course. Mm-hmm. Occupying Wall Street. Very good. Now, 2011 was the global year of protest, it seemed. Here in the U.S., a nationwide movement changed the very meaning of the word occupied. Now it means a populist seizure of the center of power, when once it just meant somebody was in the airplane bathroom. Now, conservatives condemned the Occupy protests because they said they were messy. They don't clean up after themselves, so they're not legit, because, you know, that's the hallmark of a successful populist protest, being tidy. We all remember Martin Luther King saying, "I dream of a day when little black children will be able to join hands with little white children and put their toys away before the guests come over." So did you guys watch the protest? Did you watch it unfold?
Oh, absolutely. And it's funny you mentioned Martin Luther King, because as black people, we were watching it saying, okay, what's the new part?
Yeah.
What has changed here? When seeing white kids get hit by cops, we were actually, they truly felt as black as they could at that moment.
Right.
But you know, God bless them and good luck with the pepper spray.
Right.
We had fire hoses. Not as spicy, little more pressure.
There were some films of the police taking the tents down, and talk about neat, when they couldn't find all the poles, there was a lot of frustration.
Really, you're out there, oh, I don't know how to work this.
Yeah,
you got to
exactly.
Fold it up and put it away. The cop's yelling, we won't be able to use it again.
That's exactly right. And
it's
they
a problem.
Carefully folded them with the elastic thing.
Yeah.
I wonder how much of this REI has been behind. you know, it's an ill wind that blows nothing or something.
I'm glad somebody made it out of this. Now, Nick, did you have Occupy?
Yeah, we had exactly the same thing in London, only with worse teeth.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I can't believe your first comment, you're going for a bad tooth joke.
Why
Bless
not?
You. Bless you, sir.
One of the things that I really enjoyed about the protests in London was just one interview. One of the big things that the students worried about is graduate unemployment, you know, because there's so many graduates not getting work. And there was a great couple of graduates being interviewed on the news, and one of them was saying, this is my friend Gary. My friend Gary got a first-class honours degree. He has not worked for 3 years. And the newsreader said, what was his degree in? And he went, ghost stories. Yeah, that's going to happen.
Yeah, I know. In a sane, civilized society, there'd be full employment for ghost story scholars
or
something. Yeah. Okay, Paula, Carl is going to open another holiday letter, and this time it's for you.
Another great year for our family. A lot better than Osama bin Laden's year, because I killed him. Malia and Sasha both made the honor roll, which is the killing Osama bin Laden of elementary school. And Michelle helped Americans lose weight. You know who doesn't have to lose weight? Osama bin Laden.
So who might be bragging a bit about his one big accomplishment this year, Paula?
I don't think it's his only big accomplishment, by the way, but our president.
All right, that was right, President Obama. So it's got to be rough when the biggest thing you've accomplished over the year is shooting a guy in the face. Even Dick Cheney had his undisclosed location to fall back on. In public, the president hasn't himself bragged about his biggest success of 2011 too much, but we're guessing it comes up, you know, just around the White House. It's like, Mr. President, the economy is in shambles. Well, can we send a SEAL team in to shoot it in the head? That often works.
I loved it when they threatened, like, the hit against Obama, we're going to lower the nation's credit rating.
Right.
Do you really think you can scare a black man by lowering his credit rating? Do you really think we're not ready for that one?
He did take it in stride.
We just applied for credit in Canada's name. It's that's how we work around that.
I just think that the enduring image for me of last year is when they're all sat around the television watching Osama being shot, you know. And, it's such a clear image. You can see it there. Hillary Clinton's there. They're all there. But every time I recall it, they've got pizza and beer.
Right.
And you sort of imagine that every single day he's texting everybody who's there saying, are you doing anything tonight? Because we're going to play the video again.
I know.
I have to differ with you on saying that was Obama's number one accomplishment
in 2011. Well, what do you think was
better? I think his number one accomplishment was being the source and the reason behind creation of a new reality show we like to call the Republican Debates.
Yes. This is true.
Without Barack Obama, we never would have met Herman Cain. And I say, right there.
All right, Nick, we have one last holiday letter, and it's for you. Carl?
It was a challenging year for our family. Rupert and James had to go to Parliament and answer rude questions from people we own. Oh, and don't bother to write back. We already know what you've been up to this year.
So what powerful family had to endure some public humiliation this year?
Yeah, that's the Murdochs.
The Murdochs, yes, very good. The Murdochs. Rupert Murdoch is the most powerful press baron the world has ever seen. He had to testify in front of the British Parliament about the phone hacking scandal in his newspapers. It was a shock to see him there for many people watching Rupert Murdoch on TV in Britain. It was the first time they had ever seen a dead body. How is this playing out in Britain? Because it seems like it's a huge thing.
I have a different view on this. I actually feel a little sorry for the journalists. If you're a journalist and you have to listen to, say, 100 hours of Hugh Grant's phone messages.
Right.
You know, he takes him a long time to finish a sentence at the best of times.
Right.
He's quite a dull man. I think that's fine journalism. The other thing that was really fascinating was that it turned out that they'd hacked the phones of 4,000 celebrities.
Right.
Okay. Are there 4,000 celebrities?
Well, naturally, but that's the point. So there were people being righteously indignant, but also people going, was I one of them? Very, very upset if they weren't, you
Nick,
know?
Were you hacked?
No.
Oh, Jesus.
How did you feel about that?
I'm fine.
Did you start leaving? Did you start having people leave more and more?
Sure. I kept phoning Hugh Grant up. Yeah.
And that is our holiday letter game. Thank you guys very much. You did well. We want to remind everybody they can join us here most weeks at the Chase Bank Auditorium in downtown Chicago. For tickets and more information, go to WBEZ.org, and you can find a link at our website, waitwait.npr.org. Right now, panel, this being our special Year in Review show, it is time for you to answer some questions about the year in review. It works that way. Paula, one of the big stories of this last year, social media in all its forms. It helped change regimes. It brought democracy to parts of the Middle East. In addition, Congressman Anthony Weiner used social media to bring down a leader here in the U.S. Who was it?
Himself.
Yes, of course. Now, when conservative activists first accused Democratic Congressman Anthony Weiner of tweeting pictures of his crotch to women across the country, everybody was like, no way, nobody is that stupid, not even a congressman. But then he started to deny it, and that's how we knew he was guilty. He said he couldn't say, quote, with certitude, if the picture was of him or not. Really? He had so many pictures of his crotch, one could have somehow gotten away from him? Maybe he had meant to send it to his doctor with the message, okay, it's been 4 hours, it's time to get you involved.
Odds of it being a guy named Wiener, too.
It's true. It's the first time that we know in the history of scandals that a congressman's name actually held the answer to what would bring him down. Yeah. So we.
You know why?
Why?
Because nobody votes for Mayor Stupidhead.
Yeah. Right. I don't see a bright future for Representative Bob. She said she was 18 of Maryland.
From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Carl Castle. We're playing this week with Paula Poundstone, Alonzo Bowden, and Nick Hancock. And here again is your host at the Chase Bank Auditorium in downtown Chicago, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Carl. Thanks, everybody. Right now it is time. It's time for the Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me Bluff, the listener game. Now, we're trying something a little different in this special year interview show. We're going to play with a member of our studio audience. We're going to give them the chance to be lied to by our panelists. Carl, who's our player?
Peter, it's Catherine Haley of Chicago.
Here we go. Come on up. Hello, Catherine. How are you?
Great. How are you?
I'm fine. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you, too.
You're dressed very warmly. That's appropriate.
It's Chicago.
I know. That sweater looks like it was made from an entire animal. It's great. Did you kill and harvest it yourself?
Yes.
I know. That's how we roll in Chicago. That's what I like about living here. You're going to play the game in which you have to tell truth from fiction. Carl, what is Catherine's topic?
We can't afford anesthetic, but take this spoonful of sugar.
So Britain's National Health Service, of course, has a bad reputation here in the United States. We hear about the long lines and the over-reliance on leeches and tonics and nostrums, but it turns out the British National Health does create innovation. Each of our panelists is now going to tell you about a brilliant new idea that came out of the British National Health across the pond. Guess that true story. You will win Carl's voice on your voicemail. You ready to play?
I'm ready.
Okay. Let us hear first from Alonzo Bowden.
Rural hospitals ask vets to help out. In the rural areas of Britain, there are too few doctors, leading to long lines and waits up to months for important procedures. However, you know what rural Britain still has a lot of? Veterinarians. It seems many rural areas are not serviced by any local hospitals, and doctors can't make house calls. Veterinarians, however, routinely travel to these places. The veterinarians seem to be on board with the plan, saying they've been stitching up farmers' kids for years, and it's about time they were respected as medical professionals and paid for their services. They also seem rather excited to finally have patients that can tell them what's wrong. Now, everyone seems happy with this plan except the actual patients. One woman complained that when she called about her child's upset stomach, the vet's first reaction was suggesting she try feeding the child grass. Another mother complained that her child's rash was treated with a full-body flea dip. An ear-infected young boy was embarrassed at having to go to school with a giant paper cone tied around his neck. And the most outrageous complaint was after diagnosing her son's leg fracture, the vet asked her if she wanted to try setting the bone or just put him down. After hearing these and many other complaints, the administrators agreed there are still a few bugs to be worked out of this system.
All right. Rural hospitals calling on veterinarians to treat human animals. That's from Alonzo Bowden. Your next story of something new in health comes from Nick Hancock.
A National Health Service hospital has been forced into an embarrassing climb down after a new initiative was rejected by elderly patients. In an attempt to free up beds, the weak and elderly had been encouraged to spend their day in a separate room away from the main activities, mirroring Christmas Day in homes across the globe. Nurses at Cardiff Royal Infirmary quickly realised that the pensioners were too far away for them to hear any cries for help and put emergency procedures into place. Each patient was supplied with their own tambourine to bang if they got into difficulties. "It's ridiculous," said one resident. "These people are pensioners, not members of the Monkees or Mick Jagger." And he's right, they're far too young for one thing. In its defence, the hospital pointed out that it had taken many precautions. Some reports even mentioned patients were given a pair of maracas in case one of the tambourines malfunctioned. The director eventually relented. The hospital now has a bell and the world's oldest garage band.
All right. Tambourines and musical instruments used to summon help in a British home. That's from Nick Hancock. Your last story of a British medical breakthrough comes from Paula Poundstone.
The British healthcare system has taken remote medicine a step further. Tech-savvy patients send highly produced films to their doctors. Sydney Marvell made a video showing his doctor progress in the healing of his broken femur in lieu of an inconvenient follow-up visit. He added a slow-motion shot of himself, supported by crutches, making his way across the threshold of his kitchen with a soundtrack from Chariots of Fire. He included hand puppets discussing the break while viewing the x-ray. "It's coming along nicely," says a googly-eyed oven mitt. "Probably healing faster than the grill of the truck that hit him," admires the matching mitt. Dr. Philip Jontas says he looked at so many such videos, the idea for the Feeling Better Everyday Film Festival popped into his head. "We hope to make it an annual event," says Jontas. "Many of the films are quite brilliant, really. And from a health standpoint, I believe a tremendous amount of healing is fostered by the joy the patients get from making the films. You get the occasional case that goes bad, the blood clot victim that probably should have come in for a visit. But they still leave behind a compelling film."
So, this is what we have. From Alonzo Bowden, we have veterinarians being pressed into service, to sometimes good effect. From Nick Hancock, we have tambourines and maracas being used as a device to summon help in British hospitals. And from Paula Poundstone, a disease symptom video film festival. A new art form arising out of illness. Which of these do you think might be the real story?
Well, we once tried to get our neighbor, who is an anesthesiologist, to sedate our dog.
Really?
And that didn't work. I'm going to go with the tambourines.
You're going to go with the tambourines. Mm-hmm. All right. You have chosen Nick Hancock's story of, in fact, the tambourine alert system in a British hospital. To get the correct answer, let us hear from someone familiar with a real story.
They had replaced a call bell, which was broken, with a tambourine. And we were contacted by relatives of a patient who had two broken wrists.
That was Des Kitto. He is the Deputy Chief Officer at Cardiff and Vale of Glamorgan Community Health Council. I think that's a hospital. Congratulations, Catherine. You got it right. Well done. You've won Carol's Voice on your voicemail and a point for Nick Hancock. Well done, Catherine.
Thank you.
Thank you for being with us.
And the bell that he rang was me old tambourine. Ah, me old tambourine, ah, me old tambourine. And the bell that I rang was me old tambourine.
And now the game where we invite really accomplished people on to try to accomplish something else. Author Neil Gaiman is a very nice man who has been very successful writing about nightmares. His Sandman series of comic books were about the King of Dreams himself. His young adult novels, Coraline and The Graveyard Book, were about children who face the worst things in the world and come back home safe. Ironically, we plan to end his appearance here by feeding him to an ogre. Neil Gaiman, welcome to Wait, Wait.
Great to see you, Neil.
So, I am a huge fan of your work, your comic books, your graphic novels, your novels for adults and children, but there are some benighted people amongst our audience who may not be so lucky. You tend to write a lot about very dark, strange things that lie underneath the normal world.
You see, from my point of view, I just write about the world that I see.
Really?
And other people go, "You write about such strange, creepy things." I go, "Well, no, really?
No." But, I mean, for example, your incredibly successful young adult novel, Coraline, is about a young girl in a house in which there's a hole in the wall that leads to a very mysterious and very evil world. So when you were a kid, is that what you imagined?
When I was a kid, we actually lived in a house that had been divided in two at one point, which meant that one room in our house opened up onto a brick wall. And I was convinced all I had to do was just open it the right way, and it wouldn't be a brick wall. So I'd sidle over to the door, and I'd pull it open.
Right.
And it was always a brick wall.
Right.
But it was one of those things that as I grew older, I carried it with me, and I thought, I want to send somebody through that door. Right. And when I came to write a story for my daughter, Holly, at the time, she was a 4 or 5-year-old girl. She'd come home from nursery. She'd see me writing all day, so she'd come and climb on my lap and dictate stories to me. And it'd always be about small girls named Holly who would come home to normally find their mother had been kidnapped by a witch and replaced by evil people who wanted to kill her, and she'd have to go off and escape. And I thought, great, what a fun kid. I'll go and get some of the...
And so, you didn't see that as a cry for help?
No, I instead went straight down to my local bookshop and said, what have you got in the way of really good horror for 5-year-olds? And they looked at me. I was looked at. They were not. I was not offered a book.
Really?
So I went home and I thought, well, I'll start writing one for her. And that was where Caroline began. I think the creepy stuff was just the way that I wandered. I started out writing much more science fiction-y stuff and writing about science fiction. I did a book called Ghastly Beyond Belief, which was a book of quotations from the worst science fiction and fantasy books that we could find.
Right.
Books like Night of the Crabs by Guyan Smith.
Right.
A book which includes the immortal line, he wasn't going to leave her alone that night, crabs or no crabs.
Right. Okay.
They were huge, giant crabs.
I know.
Were coming out of the sea, menacing the world.
Now, one of the reasons we very much wanted to have you on the show is because you're a British person, or very good at faking it.
I am. I'm English.
You're British. You're an English person.
Yes, I'm still English.
And but you've lived for the last 20 years or so in Wisconsin, near the Twin Cities.
Yes, and I have. I still have enough of an English accent that all around the world people say to me, "You aren't from around here, are you?"
Really?
Yes.
So wherever you go.
Oh, I go back to England. And they go,
really?
Where are you from?
And really? They don't buy it anymore?
I was in London. I stopped on the street and asked a little old lady the quickest way to Oxford Street. And she said, oh, you'll want to take a bus, dear. Now, it's going to come around that corner, and it's going to stop at that thing, which we call a bus stop.
Really?
And I thought, I'm doomed. I've lost it.
I know. It's great. But why did you move from England, repeatedly cold and dreary, to the upper Midwest? Was England not cold and dreary enough?
Nobody had really explained the whole cold thing to me.
Really?
Yeah,
it was a surprise?
Well, no, I was arrogant. I was foolish. The English thing where you think you know it all, I thought I understood cold. I thought, okay.
Oh, yes.
Water gets white and fluffy and it falls from the sky. Puddles go hard and slippery. That's cold.
No problem.
I did not understand the acres, the depths,
right,
how much colder it can be. I didn't understand what it means to walk out. You walk out of doors, you take a deep breath, the hairs in your nose freeze, and you go, oh, it's a little below zero.
Right.
And then that thing that you do where you walk out and you take a deep breath and you cough because it hurt. You go, oh, 25 below.
Right.
It's that you but, actually can, but the
you
pain.
But you stayed.
Yeah.
Why? Your feet were frozen to the ground the first winter, I understand, but after that it must have thawed.
Madness, I think, and I kept thinking it would get better. I kept thinking it can't go on like this. You can't get 6 months of this madness. Sooner or later, it will get better.
But how many years has it been now?
19.
Wow.
Any signs of an improvement?
No.
Right.
Maybe. Do you see a pattern?
Yeah. Florida. What's it like in Florida?
Right.
Oh,
you don't want to go.
No, stay where you are.
Yeah, you're better off. Well, Neil Gaiman, it's a delight to have you with us here, and we've invited you here to play a game we're calling
No More Weighty Katie.
Now, most of the questions that Americans asked about the royal wedding this year were answered with no, not the one who dressed up as a Nazi, the other one. But there are more questions about the nuptials of William and Kate. We're going to ask you three of them. Get two right. You win a prize for one of our listeners.
You know, the thing about Not My Job.
Yes.
And I have listened to your show now for many years. Is the joy of it is watching an otherwise respectable person coming on and getting humiliated because they don't know. But you're asking questions that have something to do with royalty. I could lose my head when I go back.
I know, that's true. You might have to stay here. You might not be able to go back.
Yeah.
Carl, who is Neil Gaiman playing for?
He is playing for Joe Janes of Chicago.
All right. He's right here. So there you go. How much, we assumed that you had better things to do than care about the royal wedding. Was I correct?
You're completely correct.
All right. That's good. That's excellent.
I am vaguely aware that there was one.
Yes, there was.
Good.
Okay.
Okay.
Here's your first question.
That wasn't it.
No.
Okay.
Was there a royal wedding? A, yes. No. Here's the first question. Kate Middleton's sister Pippa garnered much of the attention the day of the royal wedding, and that gave rise to what new product that you could buy if you wanted? A, Lolly Pips, the lollipop that, quote, looks and tastes like Pippa Middleton. B, Pippa Pants, padded underwear to give you Pippa's now famous derriere. Or C, two-ply toilet Pippa. About which we say no more.
Oh, I can't go for toilet Pippa because the Queen would have my head.
I understand.
I quite like the idea of Lolly Pips tasting like yes. Pippa, but I don't want to taste Pippa, and nobody else does, so I'm going to go for the Pippa Pants.
Indeed, Pippa Pants is the answer. Very good, yes.
No!
And if you don't want to, like, the temporary fix of the Pippa Pants, you can go for the whole Pippa package with the plastic surgeon. They're offering it. You go in with a picture of Pippa, and you say, I want that.
And they
yes.
inject her into
yes,
you.
They inject, they sculpt, they do...
Why, what's the unique thing about her...
She was known for her very attractive figure.
Oh.
Nick, can you explain?
Well, particularly her derriere,
yes.
I think, was the deal.
And there's really a padded pants that can simulate
yes.
that?
Yeah, apparently.
I'm wearing them right now.
Yeah.
on you, they look good.
Yeah, good. I thought so too.
Maybe
yeah.
you could carry my train as we leave the stage.
I just have this vision of sort of a fibery filled kind of Depends.
Yeah.
Doesn't sound good no. at all.
That's different than the American royal wedding where you take a picture of Kim Kardashian and you say, I want one like that, and they say, your turn is Tuesday.
Yes. All right, next question for you, Neil. The royal wedding provided an opportunity for gambling at Britain's famous bookmakers. You know, they'll bet on anything. Which of these was a real bet you could place before the wedding? A, what offensive foreign military uniform will Prince Harry wear at the after party? B, what color will Kate's bikini be in the first honeymoon paparazzi shot? Or C, how long in weeks before Prince Philip hits on Pippa?
Oh, I don't think Prince Philip will be able to identify Pippa.
Oh, I think he will, even at his age.
So I'm going to go for B again.
You're going to go for B? What color will Kate's bikini be?
Yes.
You're right.
Oh, good Lord.
Before the wedding. You could bet on white and get 2-1. Which was not bad. Let's see if you're perfect in this. Here we go. Now, everyone tried to capitalize on the wedding frenzy, including the Chester Zoo in England. It named two baby royal starlings, William and Kate. Very sweet. But everything did not go as planned. What happened? A, further investigation found the birds were both male and they were renamed Billy and Nate. B, the Queen insisted on sitting on them herself to keep them warm. Or C, one of them was eaten by a hippo named Gordon Brown.
Do you know, my heart says that they had to have been, one of them has to have been eaten by a hippo named Gordon Brown, but my head says they were both male.
You're right, they were both male. Billy and Nate, in fact, were their actual names. We understand they're quite happy, though. Carl, how did Neil Gaiman do in our quiz?
Neil had a perfect game, Peter. He had 3 correct answers, so he wins for Joe Janes.
Neil Gaiman is the author of Coraline, The Graveyard Book, and many other beloved classics of adult and kids' literature. His favorite books are now available as audiobooks on audible.com. Neil Gaiman, ladies and gentlemen.
From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Carl Castle. We're playing this week with Nick Hancock, Alonzo Bowden, and Paula Poundstone. And here again is your host at the Chase Bank Auditorium in downtown Chicago, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Carl. Thank you, everybody. In just a minute, Carl celebrates the end of 2011 by singing Auld Lang's Rhyme. in our listener Limerick Challenge. But right now, panel, some more questions for you from the year's big stories. Nick, as you know, the government tests cars for safety here in America, and to do this, they use crash test dummies. Mm-hmm. Well, some experts are now saying that in this day and age, the dummies need to be more what?
You know. Rigid. It's a word like any other.
I know.
That's just what
it's just not a characteristic I apply to Americans usually.
I mean, it was a dummy I was replying to.
Eyes of mine. Well, if you wanted to make a dummy seem more like a modern American, what?
Bigger.
Fatter.
Fatter.
Yes,
yeah,
very good.
Yeah.
The researchers at the University of Buffalo say that if we want to better represent our growing population of growing people, it is time for obese crash test dummies.
I feared that you were going to say that they needed to be dumber.
Because no matter how brainless a dummy is, you can't make it text and drive.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Even a dummy with styrofoam is like, I'm not going to do that. It's like, no way.
Yeah, the crash test dummies were just too bright to replicate Americans.
No, actually, when you think about it, the dummy's already about as dumb as Americans because you just cannot convince them to walk more, even though they know every time they get in a car, it crashes into a wall. You think they'd say to the dummy, the dummy will say, maybe I'll walk to the wall. Nah, it's too far. Let's go. Nick, among the hottest new toys of this holiday season is a playset that lets kids pretend to be what?
It's a dog poo playset type thing. Is it something like that?
No, they get to, you know how kids like to play roles?
Oh, I see. So it might be like
kids like to be firemen, they like to be postmen, they like to be astronauts.
There's
this
one now where they let them pretend to be unemployed.
Yeah.
Oh, they love it.
Okay. Air hostess?
You're close. It has to do with airlines.
Is it?
Yes.
Immigration officers. People who search you. That's
oh, isn't that fun? Little Jimmy is deporting little Taylor. You're right about searching you. Yes, it's actually, you're right. It's a TSA airport security agent.
TSA my heavens.
TSA airport playset for your children. You get a detector wand. It flashes and beeps when it detects metal. And just like the real thing, it really creeps people out when you wave it at them. If this trend catches on of kids like wanting to play at these really aggravating, depressing adult experiences, we'll look for more toys like that, like the running into your ex-wife with her new husband, Elmo. You pull on Elmo's string, he goes, oh, you look good. No, I'm fine. Oh, you know, not ready to date yet myself.
Hope you're happy.
Alonzo, one of the curses of being a vegetarian is gelatin. It's an animal product, but it still shows up mysteriously hidden in all kinds of foods, from marshmallows to gummy worms. But Chinese scientists have discovered a way to make gelatin acceptable to vegetarians by making it from what?
Making gelatin out of... Can you make it out of fish?
No.
That's still against the rules?
Well, technically, they're still making it out of an animal, but it's an animal with the say in the matter.
Right.
Humans?
Yes.
They've got a lot of them over there.
They do. Here's how you do it. You inject human genes into a strain of yeast, and these modified yeast cells then produce collagen, which you can make gelatin from. So nowadays...
Well, hold on. I got to write this recipe
down. Okay, yes. Human DNA.
Yeah, human DNA.
Yeast.
How do you spell DNA?
Pineapple chunks. No, so, I mean, this is going to be great because, you know, nowadays when you eat Jell-O, it reminds you of mom because when you were a kid, mom used to serve you Jell-O.
No, no.
This works. When you eat Jell-O, it'll remind you of mom because it's mom.
Now, do vegetarians actually approve of this? Like, are they... in other words, are they more comfortable saying, okay, we're going to eat some human DNA with yeast rather than, you know, a cow? Or, I mean,
I don't know. Is that okay?
I think you have to go vegetarian to vegetarian. I don't think there's going to be a group answer for that.
You think? Now, humans...
They don't vote as a group, because if they did, but Mitt Romney would be a vegetarian.
There's always room for Jake.
Coming up, it's Lightning Fill in the Blank, but first it's the game where you have to listen for the rhyme. And once again, we're playing with a member of our studio audience. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our next contestant. There you go. Hi, what's your name?
My name's Lou Medell. I'm from Chicago.
Oh, really? What do
yes,
you do here in Chicago?
I'm a graphic designer.
Oh, really? So
yes,
you,
I am.
Do you do, like, books and posters and that sort of thing?
Packaging, mostly.
Really?
Yes.
Have you ever, like, said, let's take this package, instead of making it a rectangle, we'll make it a rhombus. We'll make it a...
I did that this week.
Did you really?
I did. I really did. Yes.
Because I thought I was joking. You actually made a rhomboid package?
Yes, yes. We're working out the details.
Well, welcome to our show. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to play, our listener limerick challenge. This time, we're going to pay homage to that source of some of the best news we get all year, and that is, of course, Great Britain. Carl is going to perform for you three limericks, each about a news story from Britain this year, with the last word or phrase missing from each of them. Your job, of course, finish that limerick 2 times out of 3. Do that, you'll win our prize. Ready to go?
Yes.
Absolutely. Here we go. Here is your first British news limerick.
My abduction has me taking stock. A whole hour, poof, gone. What a shock. It is E.T.'s attack. Oh, wait, we fell back, and I didn't turn back my...
clock.
Yes! Very good. Of the thousand of classified documents related to UFOs and the search for them in Britain that were released this year by the British government, our favorite one was about the guy who called up the government and said that he had been abducted by aliens. And he knew because when he woke up, it was an hour later than it was supposed to be. And he couldn't account for the hour. It turns out that it had changed to daylight savings time. He then said, yes. He said, yes, but what about that huge glowing object in the sky? And they said, sir, it's day. Here's your next British limerick.
This yeast extract, I hold my jar tight, because my taste for it might cause a bar fight. Now a truckload has spilled, and I feel quite ill, because they've lost 20 tons of good.
Can I have a clue?
Well, let's hear it one more time.
Yes.
This is a tough one. It pertains to a British product.
This yeast extract, I hold my jar tight, because my taste for it might cause a bar fight. Now a truckload has spilled, and I feel quite ill, because they've lost 20 tons of good.
Ale?
We moved into free verse. No, actually, it's a tough one. It's the answer is Marmite. You ever heard of Marmite?
No,
I've never heard of Marmite. Marmite is it's this sort of strange food that British people like to eat. It's made of yeast extract, and the taste was once described to me as chocolate flavored death. But the Brits love it, and what happened was 23 tons of this stuff were spilled on a British highway this year in South Yorkshire. They say that the truck lost control and crashed, but what happened was the truck got a taste of it and then vomited all over the road. Nick, have you ever had Marmite?
I don't like it. I don't
really?
Like it. Yeah, it's one of those things. It splits people down the middle. It's well.
Is that its effect
both,
on you? You eat it and it splits you down the middle?
Both literally.
That's terrible.
And metaphorically.
Really?
Yeah.
You'd think that would keep people away from it.
Yeah.
This is not a problem because you have one more British-themed limerick to do. Let's hear it.
My carriage ride's taking its course. The constable stops me by force. Sure, I'm drunk off my head, but for running a red, I am blaming my colorblind
horse.
Yes, your colorblind horse is the answer. This summer in South Yorkshire, a British man was arrested for running a red light in his horse cart, right? And when they said to him, well, what happened? Are you drunk? He said, no, the reason that I ran the red light is my horse is colorblind. He thought the light was green. He didn't know it had turned red. Police were skeptical until they noticed that the horse's socks did not match. Carl, how did our guest do in the show?
Lou had 2 correct answers, Peter, and that's good enough to win our prize. Congratulations, Lou.
Well done, Lou. Very well done.
Thank you.
Now on to our final game, Lightning Fill in the Blank. Each of our players will have 60 seconds in which to answer as many fill-in-the-blank questions as he or she can. Each correct answer now worth 2 points. Carl, can you give us the scores?
Nick Hancock has the lead, Peter. He has 6 points. Alonzo Bowden is second with 5. Paula Poundstone has 3.
All right.
I don't like the looks of it.
So, Paula, you're up first.
Yeah.
The clock will start when I begin your first question, fill in the blank.
Yeah.
Now, all of your questions will be about dangers that were faced in 2011. Nuclear reactors were damaged in March after an earthquake and tsunami struck in blank?
Japan.
Right. Despite predictions by Reverend Harold Camping on May 21st and October 21st, the world failed to blank.
End.
Right. In April, the FAA launched an investigation after multiple reports of air traffic controllers blanking on duty.
Sleeping.
Right. Violence erupted at Black Friday sales across the United States, most notably when a woman at a California Walmart blanked rival customers.
Pepper sprayed them.
Yeah, to
they
force
had it coming.
His tenants. Was it you, Paula?
You know what? Somebody stands in the way of a product and me and they get it.
To force his tenants to move out, a Shanghai landlord blanked.
Pepper sprayed them.
No, dumped 110 pounds of scorpions into their apartments.
That's right. How could I have forgotten that?
In September and October, NASA issued warnings about two different defunct blanks falling to Earth.
Satellites.
Right. Despite five serious injuries to performers, the Broadway musical Blank finally opened in July.
Spider-Man.
Yes, turn off the dark. A British golf course was evacuated, and police helicopters were dispatched after a blank was spotted in the vicinity.
Interesting activity.
No. Can't have that around golf, is that what you're saying?
I hate golf.
Apparently. No, the police were scrambled and the helicopters were sent when a stuffed tiger was found in the vicinity.
Yeah.
They sent the police units and the police helicopters to observe.
Huh.
And they realized they were not dealing with a marauding man-eater they thought they were dealing with when the air blast from the police helicopter caused it to blow over onto its side.
Tiger seen on golf course.
Exactly, who knew?
Yeah.
Carl, how did Paula do in our quiz?
Paula had 6 correct answers for 12 more points. She now has 15 points, and Paula has taken the lead.
Well done. All right, very good. Alonzo, you're up next. All your questions, sir, are about good news we got this year.
Was there any?
There was some. I've got a few examples. In October, it was announced that all U.S. troops would be home from blank by January 1st.
Iraq.
Right. After 2 years in prison on espionage charges, 2 American hikers were released from captivity in blank.
Iran.
Right. After angry customer reaction, DVD outfit blank canceled their plan to split into 2 companies.
Netflix.
Right. A news broadcast in Canada was nearly derailed when the sports announcer blanked.
Passed out?
No, won the lottery during the broadcast. After a very public battle with CBS, actor blank was finally replaced on the show 2.5 Men.
Charlie Sheen.
Right, after canceling nearly a quarter of the season, players and owners in the blank finally agreed to a new contract.
NBA.
Yes, a blind man in England whose seeing eye dog went blind was able to get a blank in March.
A new dog?
No, a guide dog for the guide dog.
Wait a minute, wouldn't that be a new dog?
Well.
yeah.
Carl, you're the final authority. Does he get credit for that answer?
It has to be a guide dog for a guide dog.
Yeah. Complain to him, man.
I can't work here.
Graham Wasp was devastated when his dog Edward lost his sight. But not for long. He just got Opal, a guide dog for his guide dog. If the guide dog's guide dog goes blind, it'll get a guide dog, guide dog, and so on, making this the rare story that gets more and more hilarious as it gets more and more tragic. Carl, how did Alonzo Bowden do in our quiz?
He had 5 correct answers for 10 more points. He now has 15 points and is tied with the lead.
All right. Well, then, how many, then, does Mr. Hancock need to take this away from them?
5 correct answers.
5 correct answers. Here we go. All of your questions are going to be about things that came to an end this year. Endings in 2011.
Okay.
Here we go. Fill in the blank. After 25 years in the air, daytime talk show host blank left to start her own network.
Oprah?
Yes, Oprah. Of Apple aficionados across the world mourned the death of founder blank.
Steve Jobs.
Right. After just 72 days of marriage, reality star blank announced she was getting a divorce.
Kim Kardashian.
Yes, indeed. In July, bookstore chain blank announced it was liquidating and closing its remaining stores.
Foils.
No, very good, though. Borders here in America. Mm. After his new boat sunk in its maiden voyage, a British man realized he should not have named it blank.
Titanic.
Right, Titanic 2. Global box office records were broken in the opening weekend of the final blank movie.
Harry Potter.
Yes, indeed. Because of Gilbert Gottfried's Twitter comments about the tsunami in Japan, Affleck replaced him as the voice of its blank.
News coverage.
You have no idea what I'm talking about. There's not a single word in that sentence.
Speaking Japanese.
I know. Made any sense to you. The answer is Duck, the voice of its Affleck
of course,
Duck. A campaign to get a new city building in Indiana named after former Fort Wayne Mayor Blank ended in defeat.
Towering Inferno.
No.
I knew it was
they
no.
They weren't able to name the building after former Fort Wayne Mayor Harry Balls.
No.
Just...
The Harry Balls Government Center led all candidates by 20,000 votes in a popular contest to name the new government center. But even though it was clearly winning, the organizers ended up deciding to go with the less catchy Citizens Plaza name instead. So it turns out the very same officials who had praised the erection of the building have now scratched Harry Balls.
You know what? If the powers that be would have been better off to have Harry Balls because nobody would have occupied that.
That's true. Carl, did Nick do well enough to win?
He had 5 correct answers for 10 more points, giving him a total of 16 points. And so Nick Hancock is this week's champion.
Oh, my God. Hey. That's remarkable. You come over here. You take it away from us. Next thing you know, you'll be putting on a really good fake American accent and taking the lead in all our television dramas.
That's not going to be happening.
All right. In just a minute, assuming the Mayan calendar's doomsday predictions are true, we will ask our panelists how the world will end in 2012. But first, let me tell you that support for NPR comes from NPR stations and American Jewish World Service, pursuing global justice through grassroots change at ajws.org. The Doris Duke Foundation for Islamic Art, seeking to improve Americans' understanding of Muslim arts and cultures. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting research in how social factors like housing and jobs affect health. Learn more at rwjf.org. Wait, Don't Tell Me is a production of NPR and WBEZ Chicago in association with Urgent Haircut Productions. Doug Berman is our one true king. Philip Godica writes our limericks. Our house manager is Don Hall. Our assistant house manager is Jessica McLeod. Our intern is Hannah Withers. Our web guru is Beth Novi. Engineers include Les Delarchik and Muhammad Mao. Thanks to John Zajac at Chase Bank. BJ Lederman composed our theme. Our program is produced by Eva Walchover and Emily Ecton. Special thanks this week to Peter Gross and Gregor Cameron. Technical direction is from Robert Newhouse and Lorna White. Our senior producer is Ian Chillog. The executive producer of Wait, Don't Tell Me is Mr. Michael Danforth. Now, panel, tell us, how will the world end in 2012? Alonzo Bowden.
Surprisingly, Herman Cain is going to win the Republican nomination, and when forced to choose between two black people, the conservatives decide to nuke the planet instead.
Simpler that way. Paula Poundstone.
Rick Perry will finally get through to God about the rain, but forget to stipulate how much and the world will flood.
And Nick Hancock.
As financial meltdown overtakes every country on the planet, God repossesses Earth.
Well, if we're around to see any of that happen, panel, we'll ask you about it next year on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Thank you, Carl Castle. Thank you, Paul, Alonzo, Nick. Thank you, guys. You've been great. We'll see you in 2012. This is NPR.